Come out to the coast. We'll get together, have a few laughs, do a podcast. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. Folks, wow, do I have a fantastically fun episode for you today as we sit down to chat about 1988's Die Hard with co-writers Jeb Stuart and Stephen E. D'Souza for its 30th anniversary. Now, if you've heard this podcast before, you know that 99% of what I do is current cinema, but I am always looking for chances to do more retro episodes, and as luck has it, I had been chatting with the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation about doing a retro episode for a while, and they were happy to partner with me for this Die Hard Q&A screening. The LAHTF is an excellent organization that gives the public access to historic theaters and works to preserve historic venues as well, and it was a real treat that they brought us to the historic Palace Theater in downtown Los Angeles. They were a blast to work with, and you can learn more about them at www.lahtf.org, so I hope you check them out and learn how to attend their future events. Now, the Palace Theater has a grand feel to it, and that's why it was so great that Fox provided us with an archival print of Die Hard to screen for this special night, and we think that that print might have only been screened two other times. It was gorgeous. And I don't use the word special loosely here, because if you could believe it, this Q&A was the first time that co-writers Jeb Stuart and Stephen E. D'Souza had ever done a Q&A together, so it was a really insightful and cool chat. There was a really great crowd at this event that had a demographic ranging from young kids with their parents to older folks as well. In fact, some folks were seeing Die Hard for the very first time, and kudos to them, because that was the best possible way to see it, in a theater, on the big screen, and with a riled up crowd. Now, if you're jealous of such an amazing event, I've got fantastic news for you. If you live in the U.S., you now have a chance to see Die Hard in a theater on the big screen with a crowd. That's because on Sunday, November 11th, 2018, and Wednesday, November 14th, 2018, Fathom Events is showing Die Hard on the big screen nationally. All you have to do is go to fathomevents.com, where you can see all the details on theaters near you, and then you could see Die Hard on the big screen the way it was intended to be seen, so make sure to visit fathomevents.com for details. And then on your drive home from the Die Hard Fathom event, you could listen to this podcast and get the feeling that you were with us, so that's a good thing as well. I gotta say, Jeb and Steven were quite generous with their time and went into great details on all my favorite scenes, so I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, issue 34 of Backstory Magazine went live at backstory.net. It's our first man issue and features screenwriter Josh Singer, director Damien Chazelle, and even historian James R. Hansen for all the important details you'd love to know about First Man. Issue 34 also contains an entire Blacklist screenplay for you to read, along with an interview with its writer, plus in-depth TV and film interviews ranging from Halloween to Better Call Saul, so I hope you check out the table of contents at backstory.net and consider reading issue 34 or subscribing. If you're on the fence, you could read issue number 1, the free issue, and test drive us at backstory.net as well, so I hope you'll check it out. And hey, if you're in LA or going to visit LA, make sure to sign up for my screening series so you could come to these events, as we're happy to have you. You could sign up to get on the free email list at backstory.net/events, so I hope to see you at a screening sometime soon. Now back to our Die Hard event. One thing I'll tell you is when you put on an event like this, it's important to pick who's going to sponsor it, and I couldn't be more pleased with today's sponsors of screencraft.org and the screenwriting software folks from finaldraft.com. In fact, I gotta ask, are you crazy enough to write a screenplay? If so, my pals at screencraft.org are interested in reading your feature film or TV script. The 2019 Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship is open for applications now from emerging screenwriters worldwide, and the judges and mentors this year include studio executives, producers, agents, and literary managers. Past Screencraft winners have signed with representatives at top Hollywood agencies, including CAA, UTA, WME, and the Paradigm Talent Agency. You could submit your screenplay at screencraft.org, and the final deadline to apply for the Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship is February 28th, 2019, so mark your calendar. And don't forget to get your TV or feature film script submitted to screencraft.org and check out the site for details. But remember, when you sit down to write that screenplay, Final Draft has been the number one selling screenwriting software application in the world for over 25 years and is used by writers ranging from Academy Award winner Guillermo del Toro to Aaron Sorkin and beyond. Their newest release, Final Draft 11, offers great new features including image support, real-time collaboration, night mode, and more. Final Draft is happy to offer 30% off to listeners of this podcast. Just go to finaldraft.com and use coupon code QAPODCAST. That's the letter Q, A, and the word podcast. All one word, QAPODCAST at checkout, and you'll save 30% off your purchase at finaldraft.com. So don't miss out on these incredible savings. But now, without any further ado, I want to give thanks again to the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation for hosting the event and getting us into the beautiful Palace Theater in downtown Los Angeles, because we're going to jump right over there right now onto that beautiful stage right after I introduce co-writers Jeb Stewart and Stephen E. D'Souza to chat about the original Die Hard on its 30th anniversary.
Okay, there's a Twinkie here. So we have Twinkies to start it off. All right, well, so we're gonna start kind of at the beginning, which would mean starting with good old Jeb. I know you're doing a pitch on the Dirty Dozen at Fox, and I think John Milius was kind of coming in and taking things away. Take it from there as to how you ended up involved with this project.
I don't remember that at all. Okay.
Excellent.
What I do remember was, there was a Dirty Dozen project, you know, that sort of thing. And Milius definitely anything, remember in those days, anything that Milius wanted to do, he just did, you know, and that sort of thing. And I was in an exclusive deal over at Disney. And in those days when you had an exclusive deal, when you turned in a script, you had 5 or 6 weeks of non-exclusivity during the reading period. So they had a novel, Larry Gordon had a novel, you know, Nothing Lasts Forever. And they brought the novel to me and said, could you adapt this novel? And in those days, it was kind of like I'd been, you know, in graduate school for a million years and I was owed $1 billion. And so it was like, could I write the Dead Sea Scrolls? Of course I could. But anyway, Nothing Lasts Forever, as a lot of you know if you've ever read it, is you know, about a 65-year-old man who comes to Los Angeles to visit his 40-year-old daughter who works at a corrupt corporation on Wilshire Boulevard. And at the end of the novel, he drops his daughter off the building, which I thought was kind of a crappy idea, but
kind of a bummer ending there.
Yeah, it was. And it didn't work. It didn't work for me. But by the way,
and just for any of our listeners and like the people here tonight at the Palace Theater that don't know. You know, originally his name was Joe Leland. Joe Leland was
right.
The original name of the protagonist.
Right.
And it was actually a carry forward of, you know, his earlier book, The Detective, which starred Frank Sinatra, of course, Roderick Thorpe's earlier book. So
right.
when you read that book and you read the ending with the daughter, terrorists, like it was pretty grim. What was your first take on it?
It'd been around for a long, long time. And obviously it had not been made, and you know, for obvious reasons. And I had no idea, quite frankly, how to do it. But the clock was ticking to come up with an idea because I was getting ready to turn in a script. And I got into a fight one night with my wife. I came home from Disney, and I was living in Pasadena, and. And I know this never happens in your life, but I, you know, she was right and I was wrong, but I didn't say I was sorry. And I stormed out of the house and I started driving back down to Burbank and to go back to work. And this is like 7 o'clock at night. And as I'm driving, and it's in the days before you had cell phones and you could just pick up the phone and say, honey, I made a mistake. I was thinking how I'm gonna pull this thing off, and I was not paying attention to the traffic and cars were getting out of the lane in front of me, and when suddenly right in front of me was this great big refrigerator box. And I couldn't go right or left, I had to go right through it, and I went right through the box and it was like empty. It was at the end of the day, it had fallen off some truck, and I pulled over to the side of the 134 and I thought, it's not about a 65-year-old man who drops his 40-year-old daughter off a building. It's about a 30-year-old guy who should have said he's sorry to his wife and something really bad happens. And I went down and wrote about 40 pages of the script that night. And of course, I didn't apologize to my wife until the next morning either. But anyway, so that's the genesis of how it kind of started to roll from the sequel to The Detective. And had you ever heard of the stories? I guess they're apocryphal stories about it going to Frank Sinatra first.
And by the way, is this the first time that you guys have done a Q&A together on the same
stage?
Yes,
it is. This is the first time. Yes.
Give it up for these guys on the same stage.
This is our fourth interaction, and the other three were a phone call, like when I got involved with the picture.
Yep.
We met for the first time face to face at the premiere. And then we had an email recently. We collaborated on a stern letter to the Fox Accounting Department. And this is the second time we've met face-to-face.
Wait, was the Fox Accounting Department pretending this movie did not make money?
They're still insisting this movie did not make any money.
But really?
And neither did... I worked on the sequel. They're saying that didn't make any... No. I don't know why they keep making them if they don't make any money. Yeah. Anyway,
Chasing the Dragon.
Literally yesterday, they acknowledged a small accounting mistake, and we each got a check, which will buy maybe an 8-year-old used car.
That's right. Maybe
a 12-year-old car after taxes.
Just to harp on this for a second, like the WGA has a whole department that's supposed to be advocating on behalf of writers. Was there a fail there?
There's two things we're talking about. One is the back end, right, which is profit participation. But if there's a movie star or a director getting gross points, then there's never any net. And even if there's a gross, they get it from dollar one. What the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild do, and they do it in a wonderful way with crack detectives and computers, is they track down every Blu-ray, every DVD, every broadcast of the movie. So we have gotten money from residuals, right? But we've never seen profit.
We don't own anything of the movie. Though we have a lot of net. Yeah.
But as to Sinatra, because this was a sequel to the first picture, they had to offer it to Sinatra first. And fortunately, he said, I'm too old and too rich to do this, which is good, because otherwise the chases in the building would have been on Rascal scooters.
Yeah.
And then when he said no, I guess that's why they told Jeb to change the name, to sever the legal connection between the second picture and the first picture. If they'd kept the name of the character, then Sinatra still would have like ended up being a producer of his company or something on the picture.
So then it went to Clint Eastwood.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he said, no, and I still have the draft. And he said, I don't get the humor. He wrote it on the cover of it. But that's the guy who said, make my day.
Right. Stay off my building.
And then, and it also went to Burt Reynolds, who had a long relationship with the producers.
And Paul Newman.
And Jimmy Kahn, who's like said to me many times, "What was I thinking? What was that?" I think what happened. You have to remember, at this time, we had had these, you know, roid raged heroes, and I contributed to that with working with movies with Arnold.
You made some fantastic movies, yeah. Commando just being one of them that you worked with Joel Silver.
Commando, The Running
Man.
So what happened with that as a background? This character seemed like a pussy, you know. I would tell you an anecdote. At this time, I had done a television series and called Renegades, Patrick Swayze's first job.
It was an extension of The Warriors, correct?
No, it was like trying to. It was basically 21 Jump Street before 21 Jump Street.
Right.
It lasted one season. And that's where I met the Gordons. And then I did 48 Hours and Commando. So my children at that time, they were too young to see an R-rated movie. I noticed there's some kids here tonight. I'm going to have to take your names later.
I brought my 11-year-old. This is his first R-rated movie.
So I would bring home the airline cut. After we'd wrap a movie, they would make an airline cut, you know, where they would take out the curse words. So my kids had only seen the previous movies on the homogenized airplane cut. So I, coming back to the idea of the hero being, you know, a wimp, which is why Stallone turned it down. It would have been wrong. Schwarzenegger turned it around. Thank God. So I took my son to see this, and at the moment where Bruce Willis looks out the door and sees these guys coming in with heavy equipment, and he sort of indicates, as actors aren't supposed to do, he looks at his gun, and he knows he's outclassed, and he runs away. My son, who I wasn't letting see R-rated movies, he says, Dad, the hero's chicken shit. What? all those people turned it down, I think because in the context of the movies at the time, they go, the hero spends the entire first act hiding and trying to call 911. You know, so at that time, you could see how, well, I don't want to be this. I want to be, because Stallone, in Rambo, right, when Stallone, they torture him, they put, like, batteries on him, they right, and he gets free, and he grabs the microphone and says, I'm coming after you next, you know, which is, this is the 180 degrees opposite.
Right, and when Bruce Willis was cast for, at the time, which was, you know, an amazing fee of $5 million, especially considering that his last two movies had kind of failed, although...
His only two movies.
Yeah, right, and Moonlighting was on fire, like, it was going really well.
But it was closing. That door was starting to shut on.
Right. It brought like a whole new vibe to things. And we're going to get to when you came on in a second, Stephen. But just, Jeb, on your draft for a second, what were your challenges of kind of knowing when to adapt that book and when to throw it in the garbage and really just write something new on your own?
Well, a lot of that book is an interior monologue. I mean, he's...
Right.
He's there, you know, there really were no definition of the terrorists and stuff like that as well. And then when... You know, McTiernan came on. He was the first one who said it's got to be something other than, you know, these phony terrorists. What was it about? So that's when it became the robbery, the bearer bonds, and Joel, you know, was a big bearer bond guy type of thing, and that required a whole different thing. In fact, in the very first draft, the top of the building didn't blow. He came off the building with the fire hose and everything, but I remember Joel saying, I said, if the top of the building blows, isn't that kind of a, I mean, in Joel, in typical Joel fashion, you know, he said, you know, I'm not going to stand in the rain for an hour in Westwood and not have the top of the building blow up, you know. So then you had to go back to the, you know, to the drawing board and you create, you know, whatever all it was, and so that became a whole nother thing. And then when I was off, Steven came on and put in all of the great pieces with the vault and all of the, you know, all the other missing pieces of that part. But in terms of the, Die Hard's always been more of a Swiss watch than a Schwarzenegger movie, okay? It was never designed to be a big action movie. It was designed to be a suspense thriller that had lots of action to it. And so it's, if you look at it, people have to come and go at exact times. I mean, if that doesn't happen, then it doesn't work. And it took a lot of education in that process. You know, I remember we would sit around, and when Bruce was on, you'd sit in the room, and it's like, why don't we do this? And it's like, well, if you do that, you have to take all of the stuff out. So we were really, really fortunate, you know, when Steve was on, is that he not only got the Swiss watch, he amped it up to that place where none of the details get lost. If any of those details have gotten lost, I don't think it would make any sense. Do you? I mean, it just...
No, you're right.
Steve, talk about when you came on.
Well, let me first off say, like, he's too modest because he broke the back of really an unfilmable book. In addition to the problem of the book being like 65-year-old guy and the daughter, he spends far more of the movie hiding. There's fewer terrorists to kill. He spent pages, I mean, like 40, 50, 60 pages remembering he should have been a better parent to his daughter, remembers his experiences in World War II when he caught Hans Gruber's father and had him in a prison camp.
Really?
And I think I may be wrong, little Hans visited the father. So he actually laid eyes on Hans, as a little coincidence. And Reginald Johnson was a cab driver with the CB radio. This was at the point when CB radio was popular.
Right.
So, you know, and finally the bad guys... in the book are just searching the filing cabinets in the entire building.
They were looking
for a document.
Documents,
you know.
Yeah.
And by the way, he was a CB operator up in the hills. He was not the cab... That cab driver was in it, but he was somebody else.
Okay,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Sure.
He's just some, you know, crazy guys, you know, on a radio up there, so...
You know, but this was already over. The CB radio craze was over by the time the movie got made.
It just dates the whole book.
I think the CB radio craze never ended. I'm still into it.
Okay.
So Stephen, when did you come on? I mean, because it's an awkward thing, and like,
Well, no, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
He had a deal. He finished his deal. You know, first draft, second draft. He was done. And then the situation is, do we make another deal with you? And I guess at that time, I had done three projects already for the Gordons, and I had done a television series with them where you're doing like a 1-hour show every 10 days. So they knew I could work really fast, you know. So I think that may have been half of it. And also that knowing they had Willis, I think they realized they could push the envelope of humor further. And if you have 48 Hours and Commando, there's a lot of humor. If you, this is a perfect blend, because if you look at Jeb's work, his movies are much, much more grounded than mine. I've done science fiction and fantasy, and I started out doing a TV show about a talking car, you know. So I think this is a perfect, you know, this dreams crossing, where it's just sort of fantastic enough, but it seems very real. The greatest compliment I got on this picture after the premiere is a lot of professional people came up to me and said, I thought Bruce Willis was going to die, because back in the 70s, Paul Newman would die. You know, Frank Sinatra would be in a movie. He would win, but he would die. And so the fact that this played, and of course, that goes out the window with the sequel. So when it came on, the first thing I thought was, you know, what are the bad guys doing? There's kind of a stage weight, you know, that does, it's not apparent in the book, but in the movie, you can't keep going back. What are they doing? So that's why I invented this cockamamie idea of these multiple locks, with the final lock being a fiber optic cable that goes directly from the building under the ocean to Tokyo. Now, this is the most ridiculous thing. This is more ridiculous than the talking car, which we have now.
No, wait, did they ever say that in the movie, that it goes to Tokyo?
Yes, he says direct cable that goes to the head. Takaki says it.
Okay.
So no one has ever busted me on that and saying, no one has ever said, that's the most ridiculous thing in the world. So then they said, now listen, Joel said to me, I got off the phone with Bruce's reps, and he is burned out from the constant pink, blue, yellow, red pages on moonlighting. So, if he says he wants changes, don't agree to anything, and just tell us, and we'll tell him where the movie's over. It's too complicated, we can't make changes. So I go to meet him, and I realize we grew up about 30 miles apart. He's like 5 years younger than me. And we start talking about how he used to play Army under the boardwalk in Atlantic City and what TV shows he watched. We talked about watching the Roy Rogers TV show. So after about an hour, he says, you know, you're very funny. I saw your other pictures. You know, can we get more humor in this? And I go, well, I was told you didn't want any, you know, he says, fuck that. No, you know, bring it on. So that was, gave license to adding a lot more comedy, and there was a lot more. Joel Silver, his belief is, shoot as many jokes as you can. When you cut the movie, if you think you've overdone it, you can take them out, but you can't put them back in afterwards. Although sometimes you can, if you know the actor's head is turned away or something. So that was the invitation to add a lot of humor to the picture. And then the next thing that happened, and I was sort of writing in front of the camera. The next thing that happened was, the moonlighting schedule, or the delay of the movie, however it happened with the schedule, he was supposed to be clear of moonlighting before the movie started, but it didn't work out that way. So now he had an overlap of a couple of weeks with moonlighting and our show, and John McKiernan came to me and said, you know, we're killing this guy. He's working all day on the show, and he's catnapping here. Why don't you write some more stuff for the supporting cast? Just invent stuff for the other characters, so we can give Bruce several days off. So this was an imprimatur to, like, give Holly more, to give the newscaster guy, and it really enriched the movie. You know, you really get invested in a lot of the other characters.
You know, I want to focus on your habit for a second, just for both of you, just to hear your creative habits. How important is outlining to each of you when you sit down to write?
For me, it's huge. I mean, there are two different things, and like I've done a lot of what Steve has done in his career, because you know you come in after and you're doing a production rewrite. It's a totally different animal, you know, when you're doing that than when you're sitting down with, you know, looking at the curse for the very first time, or you're adapting a book or you whatever like that. And you know, personally, if you're going to create something of the complexity of a Die Hard, You got to have the outline. You got to know which way you're going to go, and you got to make mistakes when you make it like that. I mean, once you get through a draft, then you can riff and you can do a lot of things, because you know what won't work and what will work.
How long did you spend outlining for Die Hard, Jeb?
A lot. I mean, a lot. There is a spine to the book, but the spine doesn't take you all the way through. It doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't. In fact, you know, I remember the very first draft. First of all, the draft was green lit. I turned it in on a Friday, and I went into the office at Disney on Monday, and I was fired. I mean, just the, it was the proverbial, you know, you're standing there with the boxes and clear out your office, and I headed over to Fox. And, you know, that's an unusual situation in any place. But Fox needed that movie. They needed a big tentpole movie for the summer.
Yeah, they had it scheduled already, and that's why they went to Bruce Willis, because if they didn't put somebody in the movie,
they can't. There was nobody there.
Christmas.
And by the way,
in October.
We say it went to Arnold and people like that, there were no offers to them. They never went, you know, to them. It was Joel going, because he knew Arnold, you know, yeah, and saying, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, here's why I won't do that. So, and you have to be really careful that, you know, the place isn't just wallpapered with refusals, because then you wouldn't even have gotten Bruce at that point. Well, right, you would have gotten Bruce at that point.
Steve, what about your process? Well, do you spend a lot of time outlining?
Normally, I outline. My process is normally, I always have 3x5 cards. I have them in my pocket now. And nice. If I have an idea, I'll brainstorm. So, for example, if I were doing a Western, I'll watch a bunch of Westerns. I'll put on Dmitri Tiomkin soundtracks from Westerns. And I'll write down on 3x5 cards for, like, you know, days or weeks, you know, Poison Waterhole, Wagon Train, Stagecoach Robbery. And then I might write down Octopus. And I go, why did I write that down? But I won't reject it. I'll say, I don't know why I wrote Octopus, but word association. And then maybe a week later I go, in eighth grade I had to write a book report on a book called Octopus about where the bad guy was a railroad guy. That's my villain, you know. So and then I start to put the cards on a board. And so, like, the Poison Waterhole could be the opening scene, or the horse is dead, or it could be the middle of the movie, the wagon train gets, you know. So I'll start moving them around, and kind of one-celled animals, some of the cards start to accumulate. And even though I don't have the whole thing worked out, I have a bulletin board. I have nesting bulletin boards I had a carpenter make for me. And I have Act 1, Act 2, Act 3, and they unfold, you know, sort of like very dynamic. And so finally, when some cards start to accumulate, I'll start writing that section of the movie, even though I don't know the rest of the movie. This works for me, but then the studio, they want a treatment sometimes. And all I need is the cards. But the treatment is sometimes torture. He spared me all this because there was a script, so I didn't really have to outline. What I did have to lay out was, I had to work out the geography of the building, because I would say, well, he has to go from here to there, and they gave me a blueprint of the building.
The building was, that's where I went and did the research.
Yeah.
Because
it shows, yeah.
Yeah, because that building was going up at the time, and I'd never been in high-rise buildings. So I went over to Fox Plaza, and I talked to the building manager, and he was the most perverse guy. He was from the Bronx. And he said, have you ever been on a high-speed elevator? And I said, no, I've never been on top of a regular elevator. He said, well, let me take you up there. So we both got up onto the thing. And he said, oh, hang on. One of us has got to get down to do And then he closes the door. And he pushes the button, and boom, we're off to the top. And, you know, things like the photograph, the pin up and stuff like that, all of that is in the building. Every place in that building that you
see. So the topless girl on the wall was just a part of the building?
All of that is, and as Steve said, you have to be able to have the geography. The audience needs to know. If you look at the movie, you'll see the chains hanging down in the stairway, but that stairway is there. You know, there was very little of that other than the office,
yeah,
which was constructed on the set.
Yeah, I for the big final fight, I walked through that whole location with Charlie Petrone and the stunt crew and worked that whole fight. I've always felt that, you know, the fight in a cowboy saloon where people are hitting each other over the head with bottles and chairs should be different than the fight in NASA headquarters. And a lot of times people don't do that, just do the same damn fight. And to use the actual geography, it kind of feels authentic, it feels gritty, it doesn't feel choreographed.
Well, yeah, location is really important, and it gives you a kind of Hitchcockian sense,
yes,
of where you are.
Well, he's the master of that, like in the original Man Who Knew Too Much, which is Switzerland, right? There's a secret message from spies in a chocolate bar. In Foreign Correspondent, a big clue is a windmill's going against the wind, you know? I've tried to emulate that in everything I've done. But anyway, in this one, I did not have to outline, but I really had to make maps. You know what Hans Gruber's doing, like all through the movie? And at one time, he said to me, what am I doing? Look, I'll tell you another thing that's ridiculous. Once the robbery got more complicated, right, and he's mind-fucking the authorities, if you look at the movie, not only is this safe with the multiple locks preposterous, makes no sense, but are we supposed to believe that back in Germany, before they left, he didn't tell everybody what the plan was? I mean, when he says, what's next? And we say, what the fuck? Why don't you tell us what we're... They keep going, what are we doing next? You know, it makes zero sense.
But it keeps the audience...
It keeps the audience intrigued. What are they doing? You don't know that they're not terrorists for a really long time.
And maybe Hans doesn't trust some of his cohorts
well,
and he didn't want them to know.
Now you're justifying our bullshit.
I'm trying to help you, man.
But the movie works so quickly. But one of the things that makes it work is you actually want the villains to succeed because you are puzzled what their deal is. Like as soon as he says, who said we are terrorists, the audience is intrigued. Right? So actually at every step of the way, and then by having the FBI, having the authorities be kind of dicks, you start to actually root for the bad guy. And also the construction of the movie is you sort of sense, well, it's going to be really a long time before Bruce Willis meets Alan Rickman just by the nature of the movie.
We'll get to that.
No, but I'm saying you sense that in the seat of your pants, so you want the bad guys to keep winning.
Absolutely. Just show of hands tonight. How many people were seeing Die Hard for the first time? Because I know there were some first-timers. All right. Very good. Very good. Some front row people here. Good. Awesome. Awesome. For the podcast, since I know that there are some listeners that have never seen it, this is going to be our last question before we go full on into the spoilers. And yes,
okay, all right.
Somehow there's spoilers for a 30-year-old movie. Absolutely. When did the title become Die Hard?
Because there's a lot of different stories. Joel changed the title, and I can remember.
It was Joel Silver, yes.
It was very early on in the process. Joel came and said, he said, I've always wanted to make a movie called Die Hard, which I have an interesting aside to that. And he said, so Nothing Lasts Forever is gone, and it was pretty quick. I probably did two drafts with the title, and Joel wasn't even on the movie. It was Larry's movie, and he was making the movie, and he brought Joel on because Joel had wrapped, I guess, Lethal at the time, and he was coming over to do that. But anyway, Joel came on, and he said, we're going to do that. And I'll never forget, because I was in this great meeting with Roderick Thorpe. And Roderick came in and said, you can't change the title. You cannot change the title. And he said, oh, I've got all these people. Well, no, they won't even know it's Nothing Lasts Forever. And I remember Joel saying, how many were that? Like 150? I mean, how many are we talking about? You know? He said, the best thing that ever happened to this movie is that it's going to be Die Hard, and everybody will go out and read your book. You should change the title of your book to Die Hard.
They did. The paperback edition said Die Hard, formerly Last.
I absolutely will never forget that. But, it's funny how these things kind of slowly begin to evolve like that.
Well, Larry Gordon said that Nothing Lasts Forever sounds like a chick flick. And strangely enough, about 4 years later, there was a movie called Nothing Lasts Forever. There was a chick flick.
Did Larry produce it?
No. All right. But his instinct was right. It made it
good.
Now, what I heard about the title was that was the title of Shane Black's spec script, Last Boy Scout.
That's what the aside was. I'm
sorry, I ruined your
story. No, that's okay. I was in Austin, and we're sitting there in a panel like this, and I've known Shane for... 30 years, and so we're sitting there, and somebody says that about the Die Hard, and I said, well, it was Joel's title, and Shane goes ballistic. He goes, he told you that? He told, that's his title? That's my title. And he got up and he took over the whole, it was just the two of us up here. So anyway.
Well, and from everything that I've read, Shane says that Die Hard was the original title for The Last Boy Scout, and Joel talked him out of it. Because he already had the idea of Last Boy Scout somehow. And Joel wanted Die Hard for this movie, which is just crazy.
He did that to me. I had titles on two projects that have never gotten filmed yet. And he would call me, listen, I'll use your title on something else. You know,
Which ones?
None of them got made. He said, I need this title for another project, but it never saw the light of day. But the titles are fungible.
And by the way, that's Joel. I mean, I was directing a movie, and we're right in the middle of everything, and I get this call because he's producing one of my spec script of mine. And he's got another director, and he says, I need a rewrite right now. I'm directing a movie. And I said, Joel, we're getting ready to shoot. You know, we're shooting 6 day weeks and stuff like that. And he said, so? But that's the way he operates.
Long ago, I interned for Joel Silver, and that sounds accurate.
Yeah. I was on location for The Running Man, and he called me up and said, listen, I need you to dictate a rewrite of the last scene of Commando. And I go, well, what is the scene? Yeah, the scene at the U.S. Naval artillery range. In the end of the movie, The bad guy grabbed the girl, got in a speedboat. They're on an island in the Channel Islands, and flees. Arnold jumps in another boat and chases him. They exchange gunfire. A bullet hits the tank of the first thing. He pulls in the nearest island. You remember in the middle of Commando, I'm trying to change movies, but there's a scene where they say, unidentified aircraft, identify yourself. And a wonderful actor who just died recently from... what?
Bill Paxton.
Yeah. It was one of his first parts. He says, you're flying over the government gunnery range, and this is at the time they had an island they would do war games on. So that was a set for the end of the movie, that he chases the bad guy onto the island, and as they start to fight, it becomes like Private Ryan, where artillery comes in, and there's mines and like barbed wire. So I go, so you need like new dialogue? He says, no, we don't have any money left, so it's now in a basement. And I go, a basement set's got to cost more than going out to the real island. He said, we don't have money for a set. We're filming in the actual basement of Fox. So I said, so this is before cell phones. I said, describe the room to me, you know. So that's Joel, you know. You work for him. On this movie, I would be on the set. I would go home. He'd call me at 2 o'clock in the morning. They're calling. He said, I need you back here right now. I said, why? He said, these idiots, they made the vents... The air vents, the same size as real air vents, instead of bigger, so it's taking Bruce a month to crawl down them, so I need lines for him to say to himself. And so I went down there, and he's up in a real air vent, and he's got a walkie-talkie, and I'm just throwing lines out. So, like, come out to the coast, that was just a line, like, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm, like, still wearing my pajama top, you know? But that's Joel, like, you basically, you know, he owns you forever. It's presumption.
The come out to the coastline was a great line, and also a great transition, because when he turns the lighter off, you see the light go out in that shaft.
Yes.
And then Carl knows where he is for the ensuing scene, which was great. You know, when I was an intern for Joel, I saw him defend the Coen brothers, because he was producing the Hudsucker proxy.
Right.
And all the, like, mad, crazy energy of him was just screaming to defend the Coen brothers, and I thought it was actually the most beautiful thing ever. But nonetheless, different story. So getting into the spoilers now, if you're a podcast listener, you've never seen the movie, press pause, come back. I want to talk really about the characters for a second, in which Hans Gruber is this pitch-perfect antagonist still taught in film school today. Jeb, you did a lot of the heavy lifting, and Steve, you kind of slam-dunked it. I'm curious, I'd read a few places, and I haven't seen it really legitimized. Was there ever a team that was a team of Japanese terrorists or Asian terrorists?
Never.
There were changed? Because some people were saying that changing Nakatomi and stuff like that was all part of the thing. Because John McTiernan has a quote about saying how, you know, the Japanese are infusing so much money in Hollywood.
That was the reason. That,
yeah, but that's different. They were never terrorists. They were Japanese.
Yeah, no, in other words, the movie, very deliberately, fever and paranoia in America. The economy is weak. It's post-Vietnam. There's all this psychology. And all these foreign companies were buying up America. So the idea that the terrorists are almost entirely foreign, with two exceptions, the reason became Nakatomi is either Joel or John McTiernan wanted an excuse for Japanese decor. That's really the reason.
Right.
All of the snide remarks, once... we knew we had Bruce Willis, who comes on like a blue-collar guy. And once I met Alan Rickman and knew it was going to be him, I really worked on increasing the point spread between the, you know, the blue-collar American and the snotty Eurotrash guy. So that was deliberate, you know. Jackie Birch.
Well, once you meet Alan, you know what it is. In fact, all those guys, you know, Gudinov. Was the same situation. Joel called me up and said, I'm sending over, Alexander Gudinov. He's going to come to your office. And I had an office over at the old new writers building at Fox. And I said, does he want changes to the lines? And he said, yeah, he wants everything taken out. Did you ever hear this?
No, I hadn't heard
everything that. Taken out. And I said, you're kidding. So I waited in my office, I sat on the little deck there, and I watched him walking across. I said, well, why do you want him in there? And he said, you'll see when he gets there. So I'm watching him walk down across the lot, and doors start opening up all over the Fox lot, and women come and stand there and look at this. I mean, this golden, these locks that are coming through. And he walked up and he basically said, I just want this to be as clean as possible. If I don't have to say anything, I don't want to say anything. I can do it all with this, you know. So, I mean, but that was part of this whole thing of everybody had to have that sort of model-esque look that was coming.
Yeah, Jackie Burst, the casting director, I worked with on a number of movies. Very early on, they were doing some wardrobe fitting, I think, for Alan Rickman, and it was like, you know, mufti military gear. And she went to Joel and said, you know, he said, I'm not going to wear this. And she said to Joel, why do you have to have these guys look like the mooks in every other movie? They're all from Europe. Let's make them look like, you know, fashion models, you know, and it was a great idea. So here you have, like, the casting director really adding a whole theme, you know, to the movie. It really was, sometimes when a picture is put together so hectically and you're working in front of the camera, it encourages people to, like, pull stuff out of their ass, and there's a lot of feedback, and this was an example of that.
I mean, he does the fake out that he's a terrorist by making these demands. Talk about when you realize that part of what drove Hans as a high-tech thief was going to be using the FBI playbook against the FBI to essentially help him with his robbery.
That's the FBI was in from the beginning, but that was Steve's piece, because the FBI, the Johnsons were there from one of the very earliest drafts, but they didn't do what they did once Steve put the vault.
Yeah, I sort of in other words, once I invented the multiple safe so that you could cut, the bad guys could be doing something.
With the seventh seal as the last.
Yeah. So the bad guys be doing something physically so we could see them, and it gave, you know, it creates, it eliminates the stage wake. They're busy. They're not looking for filing cabinets. I had to work backwards to, like, what his end game was. So I came up with the idea that the last lock, was hardwired to the power system. And so that sort of, so it all seems to make sense, except it's put together backwards.
As we're looking at the movie, I've just always wanted to know, does Mr. Takagi know the code or not? What do you guys think?
He never knew the code. It doesn't really matter.
Jeb says no. Steven, do you think he knows?
The reason that Takagi is killed, and he's always been killed, exactly in the same place there, is because you need to have, and this goes back to the structure again, you have to have Bruce see who these guys are and that they will kill somebody, and they need to kill him at that point. Hearing the gunshots is one thing, but getting him in close enough proximity that he can actually see this was crucial to the whole thing. And if you notice, that's the point where, you know, Hans Gruber says, you know, who said we're terrorists? That's the scene, you know, where they're in that place. So at that point, the whole script, everything takes a turn in a way than what you thought it was going to be.
In your early draft, Jeb, when Powell shows up and he's like looking at the football game for a second, when he walks out, you mentioned that there's bloody footprints, because he didn't realize he was standing in the blood of the, you know, deceased security guard. Yeah. Steven, was that ever shot because you were on set?
I don't know if it was. I wasn't on set all the time. I don't know if it was shot, but it was trimmed out. There were some other things that were trimmed out of the
movie. A lot of things were trimmed out, yeah.
All right, and I want to hear about that in a second, but really for me, and you were starting to touch on it a second ago, Steven, is there's this sense that you want to see what happens when these two characters meet. And what's so fascinating is that, again, just the perfect cohesion between both of your skills. Jeb, in your script, you had Theo accidentally meet up with McClane, and McClane actually kills Theo in that draft. And by the way, everybody should remember, Theo lives. He's the one that lives. He should be in one of the other sequels.
No, another one leaves. The good-looking Italian guy,
yes,
that Bruce knocks in the head, who falls
and
down with Barabons.
But
Theo, they're the only two survivors.
Theo lives. Yeah. It's all about Theo. But so in that original draft, It was him he met, and then Steven, you brought the two men together for the great exchange with McClane and Hans. So talk about kind of realizing that there was time to do that, and
okay.
it's just one of those great things, because so many movies, from both of you creating this, have ripped it off since. The I'm going to give you a gun, and it ends up that it has, you know, no bullets in it. You guys really originated that beat the best and most iconically. So I'd love to hear about that scene from your end.
Well, it starts out again with Joel, who has, he has like a kind of like a credo. He says, always blow something up. right? Yeah. He'll also say, always put in a naked girl, because we're going to get an R rating for violence, so we might as well have tits. That's why there's a scene where there's a couple having sex on the boardroom. And that's why he sees a girl out in the other building who's like doing calisthenics in her lingerie, you know? You know, and my wife does calisthenics in lingerie all the time.
Whose wife does it?
She goes to yoga class in her lingerie. Anyway, one of the things he also says is, he says, Steve, these movies are hate movies. They're like love stories, but they're hate stories. In a love story, a boy and a girl have a cute meet. They have a couple of dates. They have a fight. Then they get married. In the hate movie, they have a cute meet with the hero and the villain. They have a couple of dates where they almost kill each other, and then one kills each other. We have a problem here. They can't date. We got to solve this. So the whole time I was early on the movie, he kept saying, we got to get them together, except how do you get them together in the construct where they're outnumbered? So one day on the set, they bring around snacks during a break in the afternoon, the craft service people, and someone said to Rickman, apropos of nothing, Alan, you know, a lot of the UK actors do an American accent. Do you do an American accent? And Rickman said, well, I don't know if I do an American accent per se, but I do like, you know, a California one. So everybody laughed, and then I went, oh my God, and I ran off and I got Joel, and I said, do it again. So he does it again, and he said, what's this about? I said, if he can do an American accent. And then Joel said, oh, he can meet. Then he went and got McTiernan. So now we do the same thing, and he does it again, right? So I said, so we say to John, this means he could meet Alan Rickman if Alan Rickman does what he just did now.
A cute meet with guns.
But by the way, that was in the script in the first draft. The William Clay thing.
Right, with Theo.
But
it was with Theo.
But it was Theo.
It was, yeah, exactly.
Who is American.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's a different kind of a mind fuck, you know?
Right.
And plus, now that I had the multiple safe thing, Theo can't die at this point.
Right.
We had to keep him alive. So there were two issues here, like Theo's got to stay alive. And then instead of killing yet another guy, he said, let's do it with groups. So McTiernan is a meticulous planner. He always face palms. So we say, if he doesn't, and he says, no, he can't do that. He saw him kill Takagi. So I said, is there a way to stage the killing of Takagi so that Bruce can't see who pulls the trigger?
Because it hasn't been shot yet.
He said, have we shot that yet? And we're going to shoot 2 days later. So he said, all right, let's go look at the set. So then he walked over to that set, and John did the director thing, you know. He's walking around like
the viewfinder.
And finally he goes, all right, if we move this big table that has this giant solid leg over there, and I have Bruce come in this door, theoretically. And so there's a stage crew, they start to move. He says, no, first bring me the seat. So they evicted somebody from the closest office to the soundstage, whether it was like accounting or, you know, or wardrobe. They said, get out of your office. This guy needs your office. And I sat down. I had a little trouble just to do a typewriter because I was on computers. So I rewrote the Theo scene, you know, that spot. And then about 3 hours later, I brought back the scene, and McTiernan said, okay, we'll do this. But now you get to the point that everybody says, how did he know he was a terrorist?
Well, right. From what I've researched, there was a draft where all the terrorists were wearing Tag Heuer watches.
Yes.
And they were syncing them together.
Yes,
right?
When they got off the truck, he said in German, but he can understand the cognates, he said, synchronize your watches. And the camera lingered and craned up, and you saw them all put their arm out, and they all went beep. When Bruce kills the first guy, which is done in a manner to evoke Hitchcock, a torn curtain to show how hard it is to kill somebody with your bare hands, he searches the dead guy, and there's a laugh. He takes the cigarettes. He looks around, and then he looks at the guy's watch. And I came in late, but I'm pretty sure the audience laughs a lot, thinking he might steal the watch. You know, but he doesn't. But then he searches each guy. Remember, he says they all have good IDs and their labels are cut out of their clothes. I think they're foreigners, whatever. By this time, he noticed each guy he killed, he noticed the watch. And so that speaks to Dwayne. He actually said, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and they all have the same watch, right? This is a crew. Then, when he lit the cigarette, I have people come up to say, oh, no American would take a Galois cigarette. You know, or Bruce, he's just instincts, but we like the show Sherlock. He doesn't have instincts. He notices things. So what happened was, as shot, when he lit the cigarette, there was a shot where Bruce's eyes went to the watch, right?
And so that was, it went to the watch when he was
right,
lighting.
And that's how he knew, because other people say, oh, the weight of the gun, but he doesn't take the clip out, empty clip. Anyway, we go to the first cut of the movie. I think you were out of town then.
Yeah.
And this is the first time anybody's looking at the movie. There's the key executives, Bruce. I was there. Jerry, my wife, was there. There's like 15 people, and we're watching it, and they get off the truck, and then everybody in the room goes, oh, shit. Because what I left out of the story, the ambulance idea came like 1 week before the movie wrapped, to make it clearer that they were going to escape in the chaos. You know, so they're standing there, synchronizing their watchers. There's no ambulance in there.
In the truck.
In the truck. So he says to Frank, the cutter, he says, you got to get the scissors in there the minute they get off the truck. And then he says, well, I got to cut out all the watch business then, right? So now he cuts out all the watch business except the first watch, which plays as a joke. So now there is no cop reason, Sherlock observation reason, to know, so you're reduced to, he's such a good cop, he has a sense of these things.
It rarely stops anybody.
No.
You know, it's one of those kind of things that, look at how much time and brain power and worry goes into it, and rarely does anybody
honestly,
ever
as a viewer, when I first saw it, I just figure he has a distrust of anyone he meets. So he gave him an empty gun to make him feel better, but yeah, I most certainly didn't.
Tested him, yeah.
And
again, if he was wrong, the guy wouldn't pull the trigger.
Folks, I'm cutting in to remind you that you could see Die Hard on the big screen if you live in the U.S. because Fathom Events is having not one, but two national Die Hard days. That's right, on Sunday, November 11th, 2018, and Wednesday, November 14th, 2018, Fathom Events is showing Die Hard on the big screen nationally. All you have to do is go to fathomevents.com, where you could see all the details on theaters near you, plus showtimes and ticket details, and then you could see Die Hard on the big screen, the way it was intended to be seen. So make sure to visit fathomevents.com for details. I gotta say, I'm quite pleased to report that issue 34 of Backstory Magazine went live recently at backstory.net, and it's our First Man issue. You could read our cover stories with First Man screenwriter Josh Singer, director Damien Chazelle, and even historian James R. Hansen for all the important details you'd love to know about First Man. Backstory issue 34 also has an entire Blacklist screenplay for you to read, along with an interview with its writer, plus issue 34 has in-depth TV interviews, including writer and exec producer Thomas Schnaz for Better Call Saul, series creator Dave Holstein for Kidding, and head writer Brandon Aumann for Star Wars Resistance. As for our in-depth film coverage, we have writer-director Gareth Edwards for Apostle. For Bad Times at the El Royale, we have three great pieces, one with writer-director Drew Goddard, another with producer Jeremy Latcham, and finally actor Lewis Pullman, who plays Miles in the film. Plus, we chatted with co-writer Danny McBride and co-writer-director David Gordon Green about the awesome new Halloween flick. Director Jeremy Saunier for Hold the Dark, writer-director David Lowry for The Old Man and the Gun, and there's so much more to explore in issue 34, so I hope you check out the entire table of contents at backstory.net. Remember, you could read Backstory on a desktop or laptop at backstory.net, or you could even check out our iPad app or read us in Google Play on an Android tablet, so we've made it easy for you to read us. Look, you could even read a free issue at backstory.net to get a better sense of who we are and what we do. If you'd like to attend one of my LA screenings, you could sign up to get free email invites. Just go to backstory.net/events to sign up, and I would love to see you at an event, so I hope you do it. Look, it really means a lot to me to have my podcast listeners support my passion project, so thanks for checking out backstory.net. Now, as we get back to this amazing Die Hard Q&A, I definitely want to again thank the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation and the Palace Theater for hosting the event. I also want to thank our sponsors, ScreenCraft.org and FinalDraft.com. Remember, you could submit your screenplay to ScreenCraft.org for the ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship, and that deadline to submit is February 28th, 2019. Past ScreenCraft winners have signed with representatives at top Hollywood agencies, including CAA, UTA, WME, and the Paradigm Talent Agency. So visit screencraft.org and check out all the details, and you'll learn how you could submit your TV or feature film screenplay by the February 2019 deadline. But remember, when you sit down to write that screenplay, Final Draft has been the number one selling screenwriting software application in the world for over 25 years and is used by a plethora of Oscar and Emmy Award-winning screenwriters, both new and produced. Their newest release is Final Draft 11, and you could read all about it on their site. And Final Draft is happy to offer 30% off to listeners of this podcast. Just go to finaldraft.com and use code QAPODCAST. That's the letters Q, A, and then the word podcast, all one word, QAPODCAST at checkout. And you will save 30% off your purchase at finaldraft.com. So don't miss out on those incredible savings. Really, it takes a team to produce fun episodes like this, so thanks again for checking out all the folks who made today's podcast possible at lahtf.org, screencraft.org, fathomevents.com, and finaldraft.com. But now let's get back into our conversation with co-writers Jeb Stewart and Stephen E. D'Souza about their passion project, the classic film Die Hard.
It seemed like when you were talking about the moonlighting schedule expanding, those scenes of him picking the glass out of his feet were
and no, that was there. That was there.
No, but it seemed like the monologues were expanded a little with him and Reginald as well. Stephen, was there something you remember about writing for Reginald?
Not in particular. I think that some of the comedy byplay with them, you know, came in my draft. And also, one of the things I know I revised somewhat the scene where he says, "Tell Holly I love her," because one of the things that I did early on, there's not an opportunity to improv a lot in a movie like this, because if somebody improvs and steps to the wrong place, the squib goes off next to your head. You know, it's
right.
Like it's dangerous.
It's dangerous. Yeah.
But I had a moment, we had some downtime, and I had Bruce and Holly improvise their argument. And we did that for a couple of hours, and I made a tape recording, and I took notes, and I incorporated, and they were, you know, perhaps in their lives, they argued with a loved one, I don't know. So I used that improv to change their scene, you know, to draw on what they had brought to it as actors. So there was improv, but it got codified. And then that impacted that subsequent scene to a degree because of what they had said earlier.
One of the scenes that's iconic that I just always love, I mean, I will sit through the movie just to see, is Ellis's scene and his sad impending death. What could you guys tell us about writing the scene for Ellis?
Well, Ellis got amped up. Ellis is always the guy who was giving the watch, always the jerk, always the one who, he was a foil to make that piece work, because if he did not come in at that time and say, "I can solve this problem for you." You know, you're in the middle of the second act of your story, and you've got to have these things where you're suddenly thinking, you know, he's going to get away with this. No, he's not going to get away with it, because you've got a guy like Ellis coming in and saying, you know, Hans. But you know, that's another classic piece where you take somebody like Hart, and you use what Hart brings to the table,
yes.
And you give him all the good stuff, and he'll run away with it. I mean, he did, you know, he ran away.
Yeah, Stephen, were you there?
He came in and said, "I want to be more of an asshole." And then he started, so some of that jargon, again, some of that jargon, White Knight and Poison Pill, it was in the, I think I saw it in like a magazine or something. These are like Wall Street terms that I just threw in there to make him, you know, more of a jerk. And he said, "Hans Booby," you know. So that was all fitting, you know, his vision of being more of a, also there was an argument about his beard, I understand.
What was it?
It was his idea. He wanted to have a beard, and then Joel finally bought into it. Said, "All right, keep it."
Do you remember any of that, Jeb?
He didn't have his beard when he was cast.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he wanted to have the beard, you know, through the whole thing.
You know, you were touching on it earlier about this being a different kind of action hero, and I want to point out that it is kind of revolutionary. That what you're really showing is a deep sensitivity. You know, it starts with Jeb about a husband not apologizing properly to his wife and the hell he has to go through to finally show that side of himself. But you also are doing, both of you, a commentary on kind of the toxic cowboyism and masculinity. The cops are bumbleweeds. The FBI are idiots. You know, they're named Johnson & Johnson, for God's sakes. And you know, when the chief shows up, he just says things like, "Kick ass," like, you know, when it's time to go on the mission.
By the way, you know, Paul wasn't cast when I was there. Okay, so if you're writing to a talent like Paul Gleason,
the Breakfast Club principle.
Oh yeah. My God! I mean, you know, we need some more FBI guys. You know, it's like, you know, this is like only somebody like that can deliver a line like that. You know,
but you were both upending the genre in a sense, in which the cops overall, like McClane has solutions. Powell has solutions, but no one else does.
Well, there's part of this, though, was I'd never written an action movie at the time. So, you know, you write one of these big action scenes, And you know you've got to get people to here to there and how it works. And then, you know, you have situations where I would come back to the scene and it would be like I was a little embarrassed by it, you know, because I wasn't writing stick around, you know, that yeah. kind of stuff, okay? And what was fun about that was that there's a tongue-in-cheek aspect of Die Hard that's very different. It's always been part of that of the John McClane character. It just gets ramped up and it gets accentuated because you've got this phenomenal, you know, phenomenal supporting cast. I mean, think about all those yeah. different talents out there like that. And there were also talents that you hadn't seen before. I mean, Reggie, you know, was not a big star.
He was about to give up acting.
Paul Gleason was, as you say, you know, he's the Breakfast Club right. you know, principal, and that's. But nobody, you know, had heard of Alan Rickman. Okay, it was just, and you know, you got a dancer, you know, to come in. It was really
that's
a
one
wonderful,
of the terrorists, yeah.
really great. And by the way, you know, we've said it at the beginning, but Bruce couldn't get arrested in Hollywood before the movie. I mean, those two movies, you know, really had not made him any money, and it was very difficult for him to be making a movie right there.
Steven, what do you remember about kind of being able to upend the genre, about the beliefs of the power system, and it's the street cops that know better than their commanders,
yeah,
and,
well, that's
and the toxic
that's,
masculinity.
That's classic. That's
standard. And that's yeah. standard. You go back to, like, Detective Story, which is a play, and then a movie
sure.
with Michael Douglas. I mean, not Michael Douglas. Kirk Douglas.
Yeah.
So that's standard, but in this case, there's a whole other layer with the FBI coming in. And as I said, the point spread between the blue-collar American and the bureaucratic, you know, FBI, he basically everyone's against him. You know, one of the things that make this movie work, and in my opinion, the only real Die Hard movies are the first two, because they both have, not just because I worked on them, but because they both have the Aristotelian unity of time, place, and action. And by the time you get to the third and fourth and fifth movies, he's driving all over the East Coast, he's going to Russia, and both the first two movies you have, he is caught between the Scylla and Charybdis of the authorities and the villains, and all of them want him out of the picture. So he's the ultimate underdog. He's the underdog no matter which way you look at the picture.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. What do you guys remember about that line?
That was because Bruce and I were talking about watching all the kiddie TV shows. And actually, Yippee-ki-yay was another show that was on in Philadelphia, Chief Halftown, which was another show. He was actually a Native American. And the Roy Rogers line he'd say at the end of the show was Happy Trails. Happy. So that's how they got in that movie.
And the cowboy thing was just always, it was always, you know, a kind of a sub theme running through the whole piece. The you know the I've
right with him being Roy and Roy Rogers.
Well, yeah. Once he said call me Roy, I like those sequin shirts. You know, I put that in based on our conversation in his trailer, and then we kept that going all the way up to the you know Gary Cooper like yeah. line.
Jeb, did you ever wind up on set?
Oh, I went several times. Yeah.
What was your favorite memory of being on set?
I was there for you know one of my favorite pieces was, yeah, the thing that you see about this movie that you don't see today, is we really dropped a man off of the top of a building, we really brought helicopters down going through you know Avenue of the Stars.
They lied. They said yeah. the rooftop level and they came down. To
yeah,
the second
that's
floor.
Right. I you know
because Joel Silver wanted them to basically right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they totally lied to the city.
They literally told him you keep those things way up here. And the minute the guys walked off, he says, you better have those things going through the fountains. You know. So.
Well, also with Rickman falling off the building, which is just such a great shot. From everything I've read, the stunt coordinators said, all right, we're gonna drop on three. And they were using something that was called a decelerator, you know, that would help him fall. And there was a blue screen, you know, over a bag at the bottom. And then when they got him up there, the stunt coordinator, you know, he had done one like at 10 feet, at 20 feet. Yeah. And then the stunt coordinator said, let's drop him on one. You know, but we're going to tell him we're going to drop him on three.
Well, now, just so you're, they didn't drop Alan Rickman off.
Right. Show, but, sorry, but
no,
the
shot where he
but the shot with
yeah,
Rickman
with the
falling.
Decelerator, he was yeah.
Yeah, and so that fear on his face is very.
That, by the way, I've used decelerators, and that's the most. I don't even think that's that the actors all know that they're going to do that. By the way, you know, it's like the ultimate trick you play on your actor is to say. We're going to do it on three, and then you cut it. Otherwise, you wouldn't get them to be surprised.
Steven, what was your favorite moment on set?
I was trying to attract Al Powell. That was fun because Bruce tried to break that window with a chair like about 8 times. And it failed. I think there's behind the scenes a video of him of it completely failing. Another time, Bruce came onto the set, but he talked the tattoo artist to giving a tattoo of the Zig-Zag Cigarette Man, and like they actually did some filming before. Like, wait a minute, he changed it. He had another tattoo, but he gets covered with grime pretty early as a tattoo in the movie. But I don't know what it says, mother or something. But it wasn't the Zig-Zag. It wasn't the Zig-Zag Man. But my biggest memory of this is sort of having a walkie-talkie and giving Bruce lines when he was like in the air vent over my head. Now I know what a TV dinner feels like was Bruce's own ad-lib. I want you to know that.
Editing is the last stage of storytelling. What were some of the things you could talk about with the edit? Some of the things that were either shot that maybe you miss if there's something that you know is a deleted scene, or I'm even interested in scenes that maybe each of you wrote that were never even filmed. I mean, I know, Jeb, there was a whole missing part of your script. There were two parts. One was Argyle, who was called Williams, I believe, in that draft, was very active, helping monitor the CBs, giving him cues on where the bad guys were. And then the exchange on the roof, the FBI had snipers because they were doing an exchange of the detonators for something else.
That's back before we had to blow the top of the building.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, so what were some of the scenes that maybe you wrote that you missed that were either shot or left on the floor?
You end up doing so many drafts. You know, I think I did 4 drafts that you can't remember at this stage.
The stage 30 years later?
Yeah. You know, the only scene that I remember going was, this shows you how... you know how they always say, cut from the beginning?
Yeah.
The very first scene, and it lasted actually through 2 drafts, maybe even 3 drafts, was on the Van Wyck Expressway in New York. So why would you start this movie in New York? You know, you can say that it's, you know, you can do it in the cut when he's in. So that immediately went.
Well,
you know,
in the book, it opens up. He's in New York, and he's just retired, and he stops somebody from boosting a car radio. But he says, "Are you going to take me in?" He says, "No, I'm going to leave you here. I'm late for the plane." And then on the way to the airport,
The woman drives him there because he hits on this woman driving him.
No,
to
I'm saying in the book he had a taxi driver and an asshole cut them off,
right.
And like started to get out of the car threatening, and he took out his gun and showed it to the guy, and then he flirted with a stewardess on the airplane. So it was like 2 or 3 chapters before he got to L.A. And it was kind of strange because the author of the book is doing the obvious things you would do for a movie. Well, let's show he's a cop by catching a bad guy right up front. And let, you know, and the stewardess got reduced to the stewardess who like gives him a big look on
That's
the plane.
It.
But
That's
he,
it.
You know, that was it. What I remember is I wrote several more scenes with the housekeeper and the kids to keep them alive. And also at one point the television was on, right? A news story comes on. That we interrupt this program, and she sees it, and the children are playing crayon, and she quickly changes the channel and says, "Let's get ready for bed," because you know. So she was trying. So she had some more work to do.
Just for the diehard geeks out there, in your draft, he became known as Taco Bill when he was on the CB, which I've always thought was strange. Just for the geeks, and I know that it doesn't need an explanation, but I'm interested to hear whatever you would say if you dare. How does Carl live after hanging in the chains forever? Or do we need to know? Maybe he was just born special with gills.
That bothers me. I said at the first cut, don't go back to that shot where remember he says, they're coming back down, something's wrong?
Right.
And there was a shot where they under him.
That's
and
Charles
I was begging John McTiernan and Frank Oresti to lose that shot or to blow it up optically. I said, you can't remind them he's still hanging there. If you don't see him since he hung him, you'll somehow believe he was only
But they wanted the people coming down the stairs seeing it and screaming. You remember they were screaming coming down, and they would all look, every one of them would look up at the body.
At this point, I've seen this movie, you know, maybe 20, 30 times. I never noticed that they noticed the body. I never did. So that bothers me, because if that shot was not there, or if they...
Well, Stephen, was that something that they added, that he comes back to life?
No,
was that always in the script?
Always in the script.
Always
it was in the book,
script.
Too.
Okay.
It was in the novel.
Yeah.
I think he shot Dwayne. He shot the police chief.
before Powell killed him. And of course, I don't know if you know the movie, the Big Red One.
Yeah,
there's a great scene in the Big Red One with the Sam Fuller movie where they have a gunfight with Nazis in an insane asylum. And suddenly, at one point, one of the inmates sort of comes out of his fog and he sees what's going on. He grabs a gun, he starts killing Nazis, and he says, I'm sane. So that's sort of, you know, like the psychological moment, he's cured. he's cured because he killed somebody. But that was
talking about Sergeant Powell being cured,
Sergeant Powell.
Killing someone. Yes.
He looks like an angel there too. McTiernan made it a Christmas movie at the end. He deliberately had the snowfall of all the paper that would be in the building.
Well, the snow thing was from the very first. Lloyd Levin. I don't know if you remember Lloyd.
Sure.
Lloyd wanted it to snow. That was, he said. He kept saying this over and over through every development meeting. However you end it, you've got to end it with the snow.
Well, it's a good, John,
and I kept saying, I'm not going to put snow in the end of this movie because it's not going to snow.
Well, John found a way.
Yeah.
But at that last scene, he actually shoots him like you know, the bishop's wife, like he's an angel, and the music there, and the music is wonderful. The music has the Christmas themes all through it.
Yeah.
You know, when the limousine comes around, it's like the March of the Wooden Soldiers, I think.
Right.
He does a little cowboy sound of spurs when Bruce is walking to the final thing. There's a lot of wit in the score.
It's a great score. It's a terrific score.
We're going to take a question or two from the crowd in a moment at these microphones. But just before we do, for each of you, what was your toughest scene on the page? Your toughest scene to crack, the one that you remember rewriting the most, and how did you creatively rise to that challenge? Jeb, starting with you.
Wow. I mean, there are so many... there's so many little nuts and bolts that had to be fastened. I couldn't even pick one. I mean,
okay.
If you look at the first 40 minutes, all those pieces have to go together, you know, to set the thing up. It's like winding up a big spring. In fact, if you look at this movie, until those terrorists come, it's just packed with information, you know. And then finally, when they come, it's like the spring goes, and it just comes unwound. But if you didn't have all those little pieces in place, when it starts to spin out, it would just go flying all over.
Right.
You would have a hard time today getting a studio to make an action movie that had nothing. There's no action for 20 minutes. Mm-hmm.
Stephen, what was your toughest scene?
The thing that I was wrestling with the longest time was how to get Hans face to face with.
Okay.
Right, and then also how we could explain how they got away. And at one point, when he has the gun on her, that's, remember that old dialogue where he says, "If you steal $600." That was supposed to be the explanation of why they blew the building. Once Joel said we're blowing up the building, we had to justify it. So I put that speech in, and then we were saying, is that enough? Is that enough? And finally, we were 2 weeks from the end of the movie, and we're saying, we got to explain how they're going to get away. And I said, look, I know you're supposed to steal from the best. I'm going to steal from myself. I did a TV movie a few years ago where this was what the bad guy's plan was. But we actually never showed it, but we talked about it. But like, so... if you see they have a fake ambulance, you don't have to have any dialogue. You don't, you know, like, as soon as you see the fake ambulance and one of the bad guys puts on an EMT outfit, the audience feels real smart. Oh, I know what they were going to do. But that was literally like 2 weeks before the picture wrapped. It was such a sort of a mad rush because it was in front of the cameras. I did two drafts, and then I did about 35 revisions. If you see the script, most of the places I see the script online, it's actually not the final version. If you're going to have a website associated with this, get in touch with me and I'll get you a PDF of the final. And so I was constantly changing it all the time as things would change, as the actors would, sometimes they would go off script and we liked it, and then we'd incorporate it, we'd make it official. The structure of, you know, the order of events changed somewhat as well.
I think it would be great to publish a draft from both of you in my magazine backstory, so that would be awesome. I forgot to ask earlier, where were they when you came on? Were they going into production? Were they in pre-production?
They were in pre-production.
Pre-production.
Not started. Right.
If you have a question, you can line up at either of these microphones, just on either side, and we'll just alternate between the two. Over here.
Yeah, I was just curious, when you guys were writing the script, was there a particular scene that you thought was going to be just too outrageous to shoot, just a little too crazy? Because all the action just blew me away. to be honest.
And you were one of the people that saw it for the first time tonight.
This was my first time.
Good man.
I thought it was really awesome.
Well, what's great, thank you. What's great is it's analog. It's no CGI. Yeah, and I think the audience can tell. I think that when you see real actors, when you see that real actor hanging in that shaft, and by the way, he missed his grip, that was a mistake. When he missed his grip and he slipped further. So when you see that, it's totally different than Tobey Maguire, CGI Tobey Maguire, climbing a building. If I was worrying about something that might not work, I really thought somebody would say, this whole cockamamie safe is ridiculous. So like the thing that I was worried I would get away with, until today, I never admitted it.
This side.
Thank you so much for coming. You kind of sort of just answered what I was going to say, but I was going to ask what it was like to collaborate with John McTiernan and what he brought to the table.
Well, I was here when John came on because they went to other directors first. Who did RoboCop?
Paul Verhoeven.
Paul Verhoeven. Yeah, and Verhoeven said, you know, he didn't have the Beethoven touch for that particular piece. And the great thing about it was, if you look at this whole project, it was like the right time for lots and lots of people. I mean, you know, and if you look at successful movies, you know, you get a lot of people who really almost need that movie more than the movie needs them. I mean, you know, there's a rationale to that. I mean, John had just got through doing Predator. And I don't think he wanted to do something completely different from an alien type of movie. I mean, it was just really important to him. I mean, he wanted to resist anything that was just going to be, you know, too crazy. And so he really wanted to have real people. It didn't matter if it was action, but it had to have real people. And we've talked about Bruce. Bruce really needed this movie. I mean, he was really motivated, really, really motivated. And so you couldn't have gotten anybody more motivated than me. That was my first script. So it was like, you know, it was.
Your first produced script, you mean?
First produced script. I'd written one other one now. So,
Stephen, anyway. Anything about working with McTiernan for you that kind of stuck with you?
Well, like I said, I was totally aware of his ability to control the psychological mood of the viewer, which I would really say, I know he's had a rocky road here for a dozen years now, but I would say his ability to like control or anticipate the psychological state of the audience is really up there with Hitchcock's. I just think it's brilliant. And knowing this movie so well and knowing what was on the script and what he did on the set, it's just incredibly smart how he did all that.
Right here.
Yeah, well, first off, I just wanted to thank you both for writing what I think is not only the greatest action thrillers of all time, but one of the greatest movies of all time and
the most
rewatchable movies of all time. By far the thing I've seen the most. Two quick questions. One is, and it may just be entirely a rumor now, based on the origins you said, I'd read that at one point this was intended to be a sequel to Commando that was rejected. Was there ever any truth to that?
No. I have tried to bust this rumor so many times. It sort of involves me. I wrote a sequel to Commando, which never got made.
What was it called?
It was called Commando 2. We stayed for hours on that. Now, as he told you, this is based on a novel, which is a sequel to another novel. So, you know, so I think what happened is, if you remember the Commando plot, you know, he destroys half of Los Angeles rescuing his daughter. So for the sequel, I said, you know, he's retired from the military. How about if for the sequel he went into being a security consultant? It would be plausible because he would have been on the news and everything. So they bought that. So in the course of the story, he gets hired by this company and they said, you know, in this terrible era of whatever it was, like 1990, whatever it was, 89, there's terrorists, there are kidnappings. This is a real thing. I saw an article, they train drivers for executives to have a safe room. He said, I want you to train my executives. I want you to give me an impregnable building and hire the most badass security guard. So Arnold does this, and he gets vicious dogs, and he gets robots to patrol the halls with laser beams. It was everything that was available that time technologically. Lo and behold, it turns out that the big guy, millionaire who hired him, is actually an arms dealer, right? And when Arnold learns the truth, he kidnaps his daughter and the Radon Chong and locks him in the building. So now Arnold has to break into the building that he has made impregnable and fight all of the people that he trained and hired. So somehow this script was floating around town for a while because it had a building. with somebody trying to break into it, people's minds merged it with being trapped in a building trying to get out.
Okay.
So it's not true.
And very quickly, the Hans Gruber, John McClane scene, I know it was originally a scene with Theo. I was always curious, be it Theo or Hans, how did he have, what was the setup, was it ever cut where he knew there was an employee named Bill Clay? I was curious.
They just zoom in on the wall.
I know, but Hans Gruber didn't see that as far as
well,
I can tell.
Well, maybe he saw it when you weren't looking.
He saw it when he walked in, yeah. That's the thing. It's funny. How many times have we seen this movie? You know, like 30 times. It's one of those kind of situations where you still say, maybe I missed the cut. Maybe I missed when he walked in. I was looking at something else. And so you buy
it. It shows how formidable a villain he is.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Right? I thought for some reason maybe like he'd done all this research of all the employees. That's the implication of it. Or there was a scene that was cut where he's interfaced with the fact that you're, character.
It works either way. Either way, right now, because he's standing, right now, when the minute Bruce Willis... The minute Bruce Willis got in front of him, maybe he looked around or whatever, or maybe he researched.
He's standing right next to the wall.
Yeah, or
too.
Maybe, you know, maybe instead of telling his crew what he was going to do, he was looking up the directory of the building. But it just makes him a more impressive villain.
But if he already saw the watches in the movie, in the scenes that weren't cut, wouldn't it negate Bruce even needing to ask the question?
Yeah, but it wasn't until he lit the cigarette and they were like nose to nose. The shot that's missing is they were nose to nose when he lit
the
cigarette.
That's the last beat of the scene originally.
That shot had to be dropped because Bruce's eyes so clearly
went
to the watch.
In the Theo scene, it's meticulously spelled out how he sees it and how Bruce doesn't see it, but it doesn't. It really isn't important. You know. Yeah.
I just reread your script. It is William Clay in your script as well. Like it's the same name. But yes, just like you, I always grew up thinking that they researched.
We call that in Hollywood writer's shorthand POI, which is plausible offstage information. Like you know, when you get home and you're heating up pizza, you go, oh, I guess you know he must have looked at it. You know, in that scene where he meets Gruber, this camera starts to go off kilter. Bit by bit as the scene progresses to give you a feeling unease. You may not even realize.
It goes at a Dutch angle.
Yeah, it goes more and more and more, you know, and it's a very subtle thing. He also took it off sticks, so even when it's steady, it was handheld. So there's an unsettling feeling to that scene even before it goes wrong.
The strangest thing is in the new Blu-ray, they had this special feature about the ramp of death that Jan de Bont was using, which was like this crazy dolly track that would go like under the waterfall. Like it was really cool to see.
Yeah.
That was a great special.
By the way, you're talking about the metaphor, that whole thing at the end, McKiernan basically wanted, remember he says, just like Vietnam, and is that final scene is supposed to be Vietnam. The lobby turns into a Vietnam swamp.
Right, Apocalypse Now.
There was semi-recently, an article where Bruce Willis denies that this is a Christmas movie. So I feel like we should finally put it to rest. The writers.
I don't know if Bruce has the corners of the market on deciding whether this is a I mean, I think it's up to anybody who watches the movie. You know, the idea had to be at Christmas, and it had to be at Christmas simply because how are you going to empty a great big building like that except on Christmas Eve? You know, and so even in the novel, Roderick Thorpe had to deal with emptying out a building, so it was a very important plot point. For nothing else. So there you are at Christmas. And then once you start down the path of putting a family back together, you've got all the family aspects of it, and it becomes, and then of course Lloyd wanted the snow to come down. So it was, a lot of the themes were always in this from even when it was a novel.
Bruce, I think, was trolling. It was the end of the roast.
Yeah, I think that's probably
right. But all
right.
I can tell you is the new Blu-ray that just came out, the box looks like a Christmas sweater.
Yeah.
And it's little helicopters. Instead of reindeer, it's helicopters. It totally looks like a Christmas sweater.
Oh, you get it.
Last Christmas, they came out with a Die Hard Christmas, a book that looks like a children's book that is a parody of The Night Before Christmas with poetry. And God forbid you buy this for a child because when they kill people, there's brains. When they kill Takagi, they show brains on the wall in this book.
Depends on the kid.
I've always wondered this, though. Why did it come out in July? Because it was released in July of 88.
Because it's a tentpole movie. It's not going to come out at Christmas time.
Many Christmas
really?
Movies.
Really? Because I always wonder why
Miracle on 34th Street came out in July.
True.
We've been over this. Every Christmas they go in there. I actually made a chart that I posted, which will probably people will repost it this year, of is Die Hard a Christmas movie? You decide. And I made two columns, and one was Die Hard, and one was A White Christmas. And I demonstrated beat by beat that Die Hard is more Christmassy than okay. White Christmas. I'm serious.
I'm putting that in backstory. You've got to send me that.
All right, I'll send it to you.
Next question.
My name is John. I just wanted to say that I think the stuff you guys worked on in the 80s, I'm 47, so I was your target audience.
Okay.
Commando, Fugitive, all that stuff was the best era for like action film, in my opinion. My question to you is actually for Steven. When you worked on the second film, it was based on a book called 58 Minutes
yes.
by Walter Wager. Did you have the same issues trying to figure that
was,
out?
Doug Richardson did the script on that too.
But Doug Richardson like did the script of that book, and it
the book
no,
was, right.
it changed radically.
Yeah.
There's I mean, we worked on the same movie.
Right.
But Doug and I worked on two different movies, really.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put
right.
that. Because Doug called me up afterwards and he said, hey, the good news is they're going to take 58 minutes and make it into Die Hard 2. And I said, yeah, well, that is the good news. But your movie is going to have to be completely, you're not going to recognize it. And Steve did a great job because... I don't know. When I read the script, I don't know how you were going to make that into Die Hard 2.
It was a big change. And one of the things that on that one, I got, all right, the audience saw the first movie. I'm trying to beat John McTiernan now, like be the psychology. So they're expecting us to do what we did before. So in 58 minutes, it was foreign terrorists again.
Right.
So I said, let's do the enemy within instead of the enemy without.
Right.
They're going to expect another Dwayne Robinson, who's a pain in the ass. So I put Dennis Franz in, but he turned out to end up being a good guy, and then I had the government guys. I mean, when I was in the theater, when there's a talk about planning stuff early, one of the soldiers says, listen, we got a problem. One of our guys came down with appendicitis. The Army sent a last-minute replacement. And he says, oh, we'll deal with that later, but that's because it was the radio operator. So when they go out, they cut his throat, and the audience lost their minds. But I used the audience's knowledge of our script to, like, mess with their heads for the sequel.
And you didn't have John McTiernan.
That's Rennie Harlan, right?
Well, John turned it down. He later said he regretted it.
Yeah, would have been a different movie.
Thanks. Last question right here. You, ma'am.
Hi there. My name is Simone. I actually have a podcast just about Die Hard. And on a
wait, how many episodes have you done?
We've done three, and okay. This actually leads into my question.
Wait, you came down from San Francisco, right?
I did.
That's awesome. Congrats. Thanks for coming.
I couldn't miss this. So our last episode was talking about John McClane as a character and the inspirations possibly behind him, but we're about to talk about Hans Gruber, and I was really interested to hear about your inspirations for him as a villain, because for John, we see like Gary Cooper in High Noon, and we see like Bogey and Casablanca, but for Hans, I've just kind of heard, you know, a Reagan Bond villain. Do you have any specific inspirations for Hans?
Well, inspirations in terms of description?
In terms of other classic villains, did you draw any inspiration from any other sources?
You know, for me, because Hans Gruber was an evolution, okay? But he had to be, from the very beginning, He had to be every bit the equal that John McClane was. Okay, so that's where you start from. And whatever suits you put him in or however you do it, you begin from that place. And if you don't have him at that point, it's what Steve was saying, you want this to succeed. So the only way it's going to succeed is if you give him a brain. And a lot of the villains at that time were not those type of villains. So you have to start with somebody who's surprising, who's constantly working, and who no matter what happens, he's not going to be like, it's not going to just stop the show. He has an answer for that. He's going to figure out another way to do that.
I would say in the book, he was more thuggish.
He was a lot more
thuggish. And he made him more sophisticated. And then when it got to me, I was very consciously pretending I was writing for James Mason in North by Northwest. That was who I had in mind. And if you go watch North by Northwest and see how the turns of phrases and how sophisticated and kind of like the little, like, you know, was that a dig? Was that a put down? You know.
But that's Alan too.
Yeah, I know, but once I saw him, and also I knew he just played Valmont in
Dangerous Liaisons.
Yeah.
Also, I love the Pacific Courier hat.
Oh, speaking of which, could you bring that down here? I want to tell a story about him. John Milius and I, you mentioned him earlier, he and I have an ongoing fake argument about who has had more movies made, and we're both lying and saying 24, but we're each counting a TV movie. So I've had 24 movies made, and I couldn't begin to count how many TV episodes. And in many of these cases, there's multiple writers, and credits are determined by the Writers Guild. Now, if you're ever in a Writers Guild arbitration, it's sort of like going to the DMV and having gum surgery for about 3 weeks.
Yeah, I agree.
So the only time you can skip it is if the writers agree. So I called up Jeb after the picture was wrapped and then said, I don't know if you've ever been through an arbitration. I guess you hadn't at that point.
No.
And I said, but it's like the DMV meets gum surgery. And when you're dealing with an adaptation like a novel or a play, the rules are to get screenplay credit, you have to write a third of the screenplay. So I said to Jeb, I said, you did a great screenplay. I made the changes that would fit our cast and crew. I kept everything you did that worked in the new thing. And there's no doubt that you're way beyond a third, probably 50%. And I think I'm way beyond a third. So if you've seen the finished script, could we skip this horrible process and just shake hands? And he said, yes. This is the only time in 35 years in Hollywood that anybody said, let's skip the whole process, right? And then I said, well, whose name is going to go first? And I said, let's flip a coin. And he said, you're in L.A. I'm like, you were where, in New York or in Baltimore?
No, I was in L.A.
Well, for some reason, I thought you were, but anyway, you were across town. So I said, well, flip a coin. And he was in the Valley. It was the same thing.
Same thing.
So am I wrong? I said flip
a coin. You're wrong about that.
No, but I said flip a coin.
You did, and I probably said, fuck you. Yeah. So
I said flip a coin, and you flipped a coin.
I think that might be a different movie. You've made 24 movies. You might miss.
No,
that.
I remember this distinctly. That's why I brought you a present. Here.
Nice, a Pacific Courier hat.
I do remember our conversation though. The fact of the matter is, movies just have to. Scripts have many purposes. You know, in the very beginning, you're writing a script that's just to be read. Is to sell the script, and then you got to get to the next piece where you have to cast off of the script, and then you have to go into a pre-production script, and then you have to have a shooting script, and then you have these scripts where you're really not writing as much as that you're taking the dictation from it. So if you know the wonderful thing about this business is this sort of amalgam that happens when it all works right. So
it definitely worked. Obviously, 30 years later, as we clarified, Theo should be getting out of jail for these terrorist acts, so that could be a new Die Hard movie in and of itself.
And now Bruce is the same age Frank Sinatra was when...
Yeah. There you go.
That's right.
Well, look, you guys have been very generous with your time, and I can't wait to see what you do next, but thank you for giving us Die Hard. Give it up again for Jeb and for Steven.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to co-writers Jeb Stewart and Steven E. D'Souza for being so generous with their time and chatting about their classic film, Die Hard. And folks, make sure to visit fathomevents.com to see how you can see Die Hard in the U.S. at a theater near you on Sunday, November 11th, 2018, and Wednesday, November 14th, 2018. Check fathomevents.com for details. I'd also like to thank the Los Angeles Historic Theater Foundation for hosting this event, and you can learn more about them at lahtf.org and find out how to attend their amazing events there as well. Of course, thanks to today's sponsor, screencraft.org, the home of the Screencraft Screenwriting Fellowship, and that deadline to submit your TV or feature film screenplay is February 28th, 2019, so make sure to visit screencraft.org, and you can find all the details on how to submit for this fellowship and others. And remember, when you sit down to write that screenplay, make sure you're using Final Draft screenwriting software. You could learn all about Final Draft 11 at finaldraft.com, and if you use coupon code QAPODCAST, all one word, QA Podcast. You will save 30% off your purchase at finaldraft.com, so check them out as well. And folks, if you'd like to attend one of my events in Los Angeles, you could sign up for free emails to my screenings at backstory.net/events. And while you're there, I hope you'll also take a look at Backstory Magazine. We just published issue 34 and it has a first man cover. We did in-depth interviews with screenwriter Josh Singer, director Damien Chazelle, and historian James R. Hansen. So I hope you'll check out our long read cover stories. Issue 34 also has an entire Blacklist screenplay to read, along with an interview with its writer, plus our in-depth TV interviews for Better Call Saul, Kidding, and Star Wars Resistance. As for our in-depth film coverage, we have great pieces on Apostle, Bad Times at the El Royale, Halloween, Hold the Dark, and The Old Man and the Gun, and more to explore, and you could read the entire table of contents for all of our issues, actually, at backstory.net. So thanks for stopping on by and supporting my passion project. It really means a lot to me. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2018. All rights reserved. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.